Okay, welcome back. It's one of those days when every time you look at the clock, another half an hour or more is gone, and that, you know, takes 5 minutes, psst, gone. Not enough time. It's really amazing. It's like plugging 38 holes in the levee at the same time when you only have 10 fingers and toes, or 10 toes, 10 fingers, or figures. CHDTV is interesting. Now, that's the Children's Health Defense. They've put a bus tour together, and they're taking a big bus. It's going around the U.S. and gathering testimonials from people, injured people, people whose families have been ruined, their lives have been turned upside down by the genocidal vaccinations. And they're getting some very interesting stories. They're rather like the stories that we read from posts that are extracted from social media sites. They're human accounts. It's the human side of this catastrophe that's going on. So we're going to touch on a couple of those this hour as well. And there's more. It's supposed to be a very nice young lady on the other end of this line. Are you there?
I am here.
Listen to her. Just ready to go. Right? She's been waiting all day by the phone. Just sitting there. So loyal. All right. Enough of that silliness. Let's get to work here. What I want to say in the beginning is, I hope you heard the last program, and I really hope that some of you heard the last program twice. It'll be easier to understand, because it was a lot of information, and it had to do with prion proteins, infectious prion proteins, proteins that are misfolded and can go into your body, and any other protein they run into, they'll misfold that one, and you've got a cascade, an avalanche, a tsunami of prion proteins. And they do tend to hang out in the brain for reasons we could get into later, maybe not. But that means Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease, right? It means CJD, NVCJD, VCJD. They have a lot of different names for it, but it's the same thing. These are prion diseases of the brain, and they're at 100% fatal. There's no treatment whatsoever for them. These are proteins. They're not viral. They're not bacterial. They're not mold, yeast, or fungus. They are proteins, and they are virtually indestructible. And once they set upon a course to wipe a living organism out, there's nothing that's going to stop it, nothing that I know about, nothing I've ever even dreamed about. Now, to tie into that, I want to take you back, you longtime listeners, who remember the extraordinary amount of coverage we invested into the mad cow crisis that broke out in the UK and then made its way over here. And we told you the story about the guy at the slaughterhouse who allegedly slaughtered the first cow in the US to have mad cow disease. Well, unfortunately, he came on this program, and I asked him, I said, How often do you see that? Do you see any other cases of this? He says, Jeff, we see them all the time. So they've had mad cow in the food chain intentionally for a long time now, 25 years at least or more. In other words, if a cow comes to the slaughterhouse and it can no longer walk because of neurological catastrophic implosion, i.e. mad cow disease, prion disease, they'll drag it off the truck because it's worth money. You know, it's a 1,500-pound cow. There's a lot of money in there. So they'll drag it with a backhoe or something else and pull it into the assembly line of the slaughterhouse, and they'll mix it in. I think back in the day when I used to say there's no way to rule out mad cow disease from the dairy or beef industry and the retail goods thereof, I was right. We talked about it then. And there have been a few people who have talked about it since. Not many. But this is a very big story. Now we have prion disease apparently in a turbo mode or configuration that is beginning to show up in people, especially those who have just gotten recently vaxxed. Those are the most vivid cases, 2 weeks later in one case. But we think there's a chance now that the misfolding of proteins in the body, prion proteins, by the spike protein can lead to a similar cascade in the body and lead to prion brain death. Okay? Can it be removed from beef and dairy products? No. Are they screening for it? No. And if they were, would they tell us about it? No. Not a chance. So we're really at the mercy of an evil force that is beyond measure in its darkness. This is awful stuff. And so there. Now we're going to play a couple videos in a minute, but tell us, what do we need to underscore about these prion proteins in the body as they are being generated by the spike protein, the shots, and the simple fact that they can also erupt in the body spontaneously. So we've got problems.
Well, yeah, the research on prions is still evolving. They're not that easy to study because of they're extremely high risk. And, you know, as we mentioned on Friday or Monday, there's a moratorium on that type of research in France based on the fact that at least two in recent years.
Right.
Were infected by these prions. And
simple contact.
Yeah, it was a very fleeting, transient exposure involving there was a break in the skin and there was blood drawn. But this young woman, 23 at the time, ended up developing CJD. The symptoms came on about 7 years later, and then she finally died 9 years later. So it took a full 9 years to progress to being fatal. And the reason it's so dangerous is because we have yet to come up with anything that can stop this once it starts. So, research done in the past, there was a very prolific writer. I've found or refound his material, Gary Chandler, that he's still writing on the topic of prion disease, and there's a lot they're not telling you as to the extent of the contamination that's currently in the environment and the transmissibility of these prions, which can manifest as a variety of neurodegenerative diseases such as ALS, CJD, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's. The people that are manifesting these diseases do shed these misfolded proteins in their bodily secretions.
All of them.
Yes.
All of
yes.
Them.
They've been found but how transmissible are they as excretions or secretions versus, typically when somebody acquires this disease, they've eaten contaminated brain. You know, we have that the Kuru in Papua New Guinea, where the natives there were in the habit of cannibalizing their deceased relatives, and the women were often in charge of preparing the body for consumption, and they were disproportionately affected by CJD, it's thought, because they were getting their hands dirty and probably in some cases ingesting or inhaling the brains of these people. But there's a high prevalence of CJD in that population because they have been known to cannibalize their own people, and which is not natural. But it's generally the brains and the nervous system where these proteins are most concentrated. So if you were exposed to that type of material, that would be a very high risk of transmission. The degree to which other exposures, such as through bodily secretions or skin sloughing, we don't know, but it's theoretically possible. They have taken isolates of this type of material and been able to induce the disease in rodents.
Mice.
Yep. This Gary Chandler is, warned people. This was probably two decades ago that caretakers and people in close quarters with these types of people who are suffering from these diseases are at risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
the other thing is, we really don't know because autopsies are not routinely done on people who die from various types of dementia. But he maintains that many of these cases that are diagnosed as Alzheimer's while the people are alive are actually CJD.
Mad
now,
cow.
You wouldn't be able to distinguish unless you actually did an autopsy and examined the brain.
There, I'll tell you another thing that we were talking about here in the 90s and regarding exactly that, autopsies, people who work in funeral homes. The organization involved worked with the government on guidelines for funeral home workers, embalmers, morticians, and there was something like a 30 or five, it's a very long document that was released by the I'll assume the CDC, for all people who work in the funeral business about how they must use precautions. And I'm talking about major gloves, major mask wearing, and this is almost, well, 25, 28 years ago. And they were told in no uncertain terms, you are at risk with these people, these bodies. You are at risk of these proteins. And I guess the amusing part of it is that of all those bodies that weren't buried, they were cremated, and the prions, which were, remember, extant throughout the body, not just in the brain, they're in the blood, they're everywhere. The prions went right up the chimney and out into the neighborhood.
Mm-hmm.
They were not destroyed. You cannot destroy them. I think the was 650 to 700 degrees back then. Don't know what it is now. But prions, remember, can withstand 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. 1,200 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, again, we're not trying to scare anyone, but you have a right to know. When you go into a doctor's office for a procedure or a hospital for a surgical procedure or anything that's invasive, using reusable medical equipment, or a dental office using reusable dental equipment, scrapers and all that stuff, you are running a risk of getting prion proteins, mad cow proteins. They are not being removed with autoclaving. The normal sterilizer in a dental or medical office is autoclaving. That's around 275 degrees. Prions can withstand 1,200 degrees. Enough said.
Well, the other thing to keep in mind, and this was, I knew it intellectually, but hadn't really processed it. We've spoken about why or the trend over recent years and the increase in these neurodegenerative diseases, and we've mentioned the increase in electrosmog and non-native electromagnetic frequencies. And, you know, nervous system, nervous tissue is very sensitive to frequency. And the possibility that maybe not all the cows that are being slaughtered and offered for food in this country are free of BSE. But the other consideration is the extensive use now of biosludge for fertilizer and reclaimed water. And given that there are large numbers of people now that are shedding this material, putting it into the sewer system, and this stuff is now being turned into compost of various types, it's another route of exposure. And
a real issue here, friends. This is not some
remote speculation. Yeah, I mean, these things persist in the environment.
Yeah.
If it is being used as compost or fertilizer, which I expect they're going to do more of since they're shutting down nitrogen plants.
They're turning human bodies into fertilizer now.
Yeah, that too. But the plants are able to uptake these prions, these misfolded proteins, and incorporate them into their tissue, the meat of the plant. And
grasses, plants, any kind of foliage can pull it right up out of the ground.
Yeah, and this is thought to be contributing to the spread of CWD, which is chronic wasting disease in deer, also a prion type of disease. So you can assume that humans would be at risk as well, depending on the growing practices of the food they're eating.
Exactly. Let me back up. You've made some very important points. Number one, any fertilizer that you buy and use in your garden that has manure or any kind of animal products in it should not be used. You put manure into your garden, and the prions potentially can come right up in your food crop and go right down your throat when you eat it. That's the truth. I only, in my garden, use all plant-based only, and I have to cross my fingers there, but no animal products in any of the fertilizer. You can find them. They're out there. That's number one. Number two, that Erica just mentioned, the water is being recycled. No, it's not being boiled at over 1,200 degrees to kill the prions. They're in that water, in that sewage sludge that is also being dried out and turned into compost and sold to farmers. So they're not only putting, and in some cases human remains, but sludge from sewers on the plants they grow and legally can call them organic. Think about it. It's organic.
Yeah.
That's what they can do. And then if the fertilizer, the sludge alone isn't bad enough, they can also irrigate the cropland, and they're doing it with reclaimed sewage water.
Yeah.
Do you understand? I think you do. So thank you for bringing that up. It's critically important.
Yeah, that is a real risk. You know, right now, I mean, there's this the specter of them putting mRNA into the food supply. We've already got issues with the food supply. Given that, you know, what percentage of the population is now shedding this noxious protein with pre-energic properties?
Deadly protein.
Yeah.
Worse than noxious.
Potentially deadly. And you wouldn't necessarily have to get sick overnight. You know, this can have a very long incubation
Normal period. Normal is 10 years. But we're seeing it now in a matter of months in some of the cases of people getting the bioweapon and showing up with CJD a few months later. This is happening.
So, yeah, that's a tough call. I mean, we don't have a clear picture of why it's happening that fast. I mean, my assumption would be that they already had some disease of that nature in progress.
And they might have had background BSE from eating dairy and beef all the time, if you can still afford it. But you do that over a number of years. What's the threshold? How many mad cow prions, bovine spongiform encephalopathy prions, how many do you have before it really starts to take off in your body and gestate to the extent that, in, you know, 9 or 10 years, you're going to be dead because your brain's going to look like a sponge full of holes? How many does it take? Theoretically, it only takes one, because one will go into your blood and begin to misfold every other protein, potentially, that it comes into contact with. You follow?
Well, it's...
Not you.
It's the nervous system. It's when it gets into the central nervous system.
Bad.
But you can have these misfolded proteins in a variety of organs.
They don't just go to the brain.
That's where some of the worst symptoms and outcomes are. But this amyloidosis, as I've said, is that's a systemic form of protein misfolding. It's really picking up. I can't tell you how many new people are coming into these groups. Young people, when this used to be, they called it an old man's disease, but there's young people turning up in these groups every day with the presumptive diagnosis of amyloidosis, and at least expressing the symptoms of it, and according to their lab work, appear to have this. And I would contend that, yes, it's the result of this gene transfection that is causing their bodies to produce aberrant proteins.
And these aberrant proteins are some of the baseline building blocks of amyloid formations in the body.
Right.
Those and fibrils and endothelial casts and all kinds of things, but these proteins may be the virtual glue of amyloid clots. We don't mm-hmm. know, but they're a factor. We're in no man's land here, but we've got enough data of a very positive and scientifically sound basis that we can make these statements as something to be considered.
Yep.
So fortunately, I was able to realize early on, when I was in college, that dairy was not my friend, and I stopped back in the day. And I some of you may remember, I use only the various grain milks, almond milks, oat milk. And then I found out, and I'm still very unhappy with this Pacific Beverage Company. Do not buy, in my view, Pacific Beverage products at all. They would not tell me the truth about where the water comes from for their products. And I was able to find out by pestering them. They finally admitted that, yes, some of our products do use municipal water. And that's not okay. That means fluoride. And I don't want to drink fluoride. Thank you.
Well, fluoride, and depending on the municipality, it could be anything. I was on a website the other day, some kind of, I think it was Environmental Working Group, looking at various municipalities and the toxins that they find in these various municipal water supplies, and it would horrify you.
Yes.
You know, one of the big ones these days is arsenic.
Yeah.
And particularly in the Southwest, like Arizona.
Well water.
They've got a real problem with arsenic in their drinking water.
Mm-hmm. It's common in well water, too. It's one of the things you got to work out when you get your well analysis done. You have to figure
but
out.
But most municipalities, have well over the what's considered the safe limit for several types of different chemicals.
Yeah, I'm sure. Okay, let's go and listen to a couple of these interviews that the Children's Health Defense, the Happy Bus, was able to collect on its tour around the country. There are a number of very, very interesting reports, similar to the ones that we read here on the program. So here's the first one. This woman is going to talk about personality changes after the Johnson & Johnson shot. All right. Now, we've heard these stories, and it's not restricted to J&J. In her particular case, that's the one she's talking about. So here we go.
Tell us your name, please.
My name is Suella Clark.
And this is about your mother-in-law, correct?
Yes.
So talk us, so she had the Johnson & Johnson. Talk to us about her character before she took the Johnson & Johnson, and then tell us about her character after.
So before she had the Johnson & Johnson, she was always the kindest, sweetest person. She just couldn't do enough for people. She just was an amazing woman. However, and she always had a problem with her other daughter-in-law, but she would not have let her know that she had any issues or anything. She was just always kind. She then went and had a booster, and within 1 week, her whole personality changed. She started being really mean about the daughter-in-law. She had stories that she really believed that it happened to her daughter-in-law's children. She said that she had abandoned the children and that she had stolen all the husband's money. She genuinely believed that these children were in a dire sort of state, somewhere else, not being looked after. She also started to believe that my husband and I were getting divorced, and we weren't. She had everything she thought wasn't true, but she totally believed it. She thought that her doctor had cancer and that he had died. And then we told her he hadn't died. And then she said, "Oh, that's very strange." And then she said, "Okay, he hasn't." A few days later, she said he had died again. So everything she was talking about was always dark, almost demonic. And it was all about diseases. Everyone had cancer. She said, friends of ours, that the husband had got cancer and the wife had got some other illness. She thought that there was some plague, cholera coming back that was going around South Africa.
So it's like a form of madness.
Yeah, yes. And it was just 1 week, totally fine. The following week, a different person. She completely changed. She would also refer to her daughter-in-law using bad language, which was not like her at all. Everything was just...
And how is she today? I mean, is she still the same?
She's not as bad. It was like that went on for about 3 months. And then it started tapering off a little bit. But she'll still... There'll be days where you'll hear stories and then it's like she's okay a little bit. And then she goes back to it again. So it's very strange.
It's very strange. But actually... You're not the first person to sit there and talk to us about the Johnson & Johnson.
That's interesting.
Because when you said to me before we went live, it's a personality disorder type thing. I asked you if it was Johnson & Johnson because we've heard it before. Following Johnson & Johnson, depression, crazy mood swings, violent outbursts, yes, erratic behaviour.
She would get very angry with people when they said, no, but that didn't happen. We're not getting divorced. Oh, but you told me you were. When people try to explain that the mother, the daughter-in-law, that she hadn't abandoned the children, she was so convinced that she had. And she said, I know she has. Why are you lying to me? And she just would get very angry. And it was such a radical change in her personality. It was so concerning because... Nobody changes that quickly. Unless something...
And is she still going to continue to take... Well, she can't. I think Johnson & Johnson's taken off the market now, isn't it? I don't know.
I'm actually not sure. Now, the thing is, she was one of those where she said, oh, I'm not going to take the shot. It's only been out for such a short time. And then the propaganda got her. And she went and she took it.
Now, what about other people in your family? Talk to me about them. People take it or not take it, or what's going on?
My parents have taken it, my sister's taken it, my brother-in-law, wife and their children. Basically, my nuclear family, my husband and I, my four children, we're about the only ones in our entire families, both of our families, that haven't taken it.
And you, your husband and your children that did not take the shot, how is your health?
Our health is excellent. We haven't been sick at all. Not at all. And when actually my husband did get COVID about 2 years ago, and he wasn't well for a bit, but he recovered because he has a strong immune system. He has the immune system that God gave him, and no other thing can heal you like God. Not something that Pfizer has made by man, or Johnson & Johnson, none of those things help you.
Okay, how many stories have we brought to you, and how many of you out there know people who have had personality changes after these shots? Whether it be J&J or any of the others, it doesn't really seem to matter much. But this is a horrible thing that's happening, and it has further destroyed many, many families.
Yeah, it has.
This Children's Health Defense bus tour is interesting. Do you know anything else about it? Where are they going? Are they going all over the country? I guess they must be, huh?
Yes, and they've collected, countless vignettes. You know, when they stop in these towns, people line up to be interviewed to tell their story. And
right.
It's just... Countless stories of misery, tragedy, sorrow.
Grief.
Yeah.
Despair.
And
ultimately, I'll bet that 38 a day euthanasia figure in Canada is going to go up dramatically.
I bet it's more at this point.
I would agree with you. All right, here's one from a nurse. This is a COVID nurse. She worked with a lot of people in hospital who had COVID. Let's see what she has to say.
My name is Gail McCrae.
And you were a nurse during COVID.
I was.
So which area are we going to start at? Why don't you just start telling us what you saw as a nurse? You've heard a lot of these hospital protocol.
Yes.
Killing.
I think one of the important things about my situation is that I was working in the Bay Area of California, where we had one of the most compliant populations in the country. We were compliant with not just the lockdowns and the masking, but also the COVID injections. So in my community, when COVID was first announced and they locked down the hospitals and they stopped the elective surgeries, our hospital completely emptied out. And this was when I really first saw that we were being lied to, because the public was being told in the news that the hospitals were full and overwhelmed, and they weren't. I had colleagues all over the state of California who worked in units all over the hospital in the acute care setting, and not once during that first year of COVID in 2020 and the winter of 2021 were our hospitals overwhelmed. I would say there was, during the winter of 2020 and 2021, when this happens every year, people come in with the flu and the hospitals fill. It happens every year. It's been doing that for the whole 12 years I've been working in the acute care setting. So it was not unusual. We were not overwhelmed, and the public was being lied to. So that really opened my eyes to the fact that there were things going on that shouldn't have been going on. And then with the rollout of the isolations, they also started the COVID protocols. And I didn't notice right away the harm of these protocols until I had to tell family members that they couldn't come to the bedside of their dying loved ones. That, to me, was a crime against humanity and a violation of my oath that I knew right away should not have been happening. We isolate people in prison. We put them in the brig when they've done something wrong to torture them. And that's what I felt like I was being forced to do when I had to tell my patients' family members when they couldn't come into the hospital to be near their dying loved ones. So those small kinds of violations that I was recognizing, I think really helped me accept that I needed to more critically analyze what I was being told to do and what was happening around me in the hospital. So after going through those two things at the beginning of the COVID lockdowns, it really helped me to stop and think when I was being told to do things. Like, the next thing was the administration of remdesivir. This was an experimental use authorization medication. It was the only drug that we were allowed to administer to patients who were hospitalized with COVID, and it was an antiviral. And I'd been taught in my undergrad, my bachelor's degree program for nursing, that you do not administer an antiviral more than 24 to 48 hours post-symptom onset for a viral infection. And so this medication was being given to patients who were hospitalized with COVID, usually not until between 10 and 12 days post-symptom onset. So I would ask my colleagues, why are we giving this medication? The administrators, my hospital, why are we doing this? And their eyes would glaze over. And I would say to them, we have evidence showing that the administration of antivirals more than 2 days post-symptom onset causes more harm than good. The risk-benefit analysis does not correlate. And in addition to that, this was an experimental use product. And I knew that each one of those doses was over $3,000. So that was another huge red flag. In addition to that, the next part of the COVID protocols that was so extremely disturbing to me was the fact that at the onset of hospitalization for COVID, there were a team of respiratory intensivists who went before Congress and showed them how effective high-dose steroids were for the treatment of patients who had COVID. And not only were we ignoring those recommendations for high-dose steroids, they were actually blocking it from our hospitals to use. So we have patients coming in who are being feared to death by the media. They're being isolated from their loved ones. They're having steroid treatments. So I'll say one more thing about these steroids, because this is really important. The COVID, whatever it was, virus, whatever COVID was, it caused more inflammation than we had ever seen in the hospital. So there's a lab value called CRP. And even with influenza and things like this, we had never seen the inflammatory marker of CRP jump so high as we did with COVID.
Okay, now Erica's been talking about exactly that for a long time, the inflammatory part of this whole thing. And I'm going to move this forward to the end. So anything you want to add about the inflammatory reaction?
Yeah, well, that goes hand in hand with the oxidative stress, and that, you know, inflammation. Tissues are getting, in a sense, fried, burning.
All right, I'm moving to the end of this because she's got a pretty good punchline here.
Needed patients were being hospitalized with COVID, but that was never the case. So it was people like me who actually did ask and who actually did attempt to discover the truth of what was happening. You know, we would scream it from the rooftops, but I mean, this stuff was just all being ignored and censored. And that's the biggest part of all of this, is that people like me who were there telling the truth, you know, we were all fired and removed from the field, and or we left because we couldn't ethically manage it. So now we are left with medical facilities full of people who don't have a backbone to stand up and do the right thing. And so I am very concerned for the future of medicine in this country, because we have criminalized and disciplined all of the practitioners who were actually there to protect our patients and families. Wow. It's a dangerous place. I would not take a family member to a hospital.
Got that? First-rate professional nurse, no longer obviously there in the business, but she said, I would not take a family member to a hospital. All right?
Yeah, I those are words to heed.
Very, very much. All right, here's one. This is a young wife, relatively young wife, unmarried, which is usually the case with wives. She's going to talk about her husband developing turbo cancer. Now, this is another gripping story.
My name is Paya Lachlan.
Okay, so you and your husband both get the COVID shots?
No, I never get a COVID shot. I won't take a COVID shot.
So why did your husband take one?
Because he has a lot of physical problem. The reason we were in Hawaii, we moved from Hawaii to here, and when we're on the island, he tried to book a surgery for his hips. So his doctor telling him that's a 2021. So tell him you need to go get a COVID shot, or otherwise we won't give you surgery.
Got it. We heard that before too. If you don't get your bioweapon, we won't operate on you. And that's their dilemma.
That's the reason why he go get a shot.
So that's when he got his first Pfizer.
Yes.
And so how did he feel after that? Because your husband had had cancer before the COVID shot?
Yeah, he has a blood cancer, but he managed really good. Every time he go in, do the test, it's pretty good.
So he was doing well. And so he had his first COVID Pfizer shot, and then he has surgery.
They never had a surgery because they said that on the island, the overwhelming because of the COVID, they don't want people go into the hospital.
So how did he feel after his first Pfizer?
Because he's a doctor required him to.
How did he feel physically afterwards?
Not much. I didn't hear he complain about anything.
Okay, so then he takes another Pfizer.
Yeah, I don't know how many... how long apart between the first one and second one.
And then he has a booster.
Yes, but I've been telling him do not take it. Me and my friends, we all know what this shot's for. So nobody take it. So I've been telling him, but he won't listen. He listened to the mainstream media. He telling me, oh, you're not medical background. I got to listen to my doctor. And they try to help me, which is not. So now he got more and more physical problems.
So talk to us about this turbo cancer. Talk to us about what his condition is like now.
He already had a blood cancer, and now he developed, like 5 months ago, he complained about his rib. It's very, very, very hurt. He go in, test it, there's a tumor between the lungs and ribs. Very difficult position to remove that, but very aggressive, grow really, really fast. So finally, the doctor, he required to remove because he can't handle the pain. So 2 months ago, he went to the Bradenton Hospital. He go in, removed it, that tumor. And later on, he find out he got a skin cancer too. Now he keep going to dermatology to remove the skin cancer. He's just falling apart.
Does he understand now that it's from the shots?
Yes, he does. So we all talk about it, but now he don't say nothing. He used to call me conspiracy, but now he don't say anything anymore because few of his friends, they are suddenly died. They just died. 2 months ago in Hawaii, one of his friends in Hawaii, which is my daughter's principal, work in the elementary school, they're same age, that guy and him. The guy used to be so healthy, no physical problem ever. And 2 months ago, we find out he died. He just go to grocery store and suddenly just drop at the parking lot and no time to call ambulance, nothing. That's it. Yeah, because I know his name is Jeff. Jeff got a shot. He told me he got a shot.
And so your husband is done having shots?
Yeah, and then last year, he's shedding. I know this shedding part is real, for sure.
Now, her husband, 3 shots. She's had no shots. She's been right in there, cohabiting, helping him, and now she's going to address the shedding issue from her husband.
Yes, and then he gave to me from the vaccine, all the poison. So I had a shingle around here. That's the first time in my life.
Shingles.
Yeah, I never had it before. So I didn't even know what is that. So later on, I did a research. I find out what is that. And then my friend tell me, few his friend got the vaccine. They got exactly the same thing. So I showed my husband. I said, look, this is from vaccine. Do you know that? And then he was scared. He went to the CVS, go got a shingle shot. For himself.
Oh, you're kidding.
Yes. He worried I gave to him, but which is he did give to me. He go got that shot, but without telling me. Because he know if he tell me, I will say no. Yeah.
I'd say that's a good contender for matrimonial bliss of the year, wouldn't you?
Oh, my gosh. There's so many stories like that, and worse.
And worse. Here, let's listen just a little bit more.
Because I've been listening to, since the pandemic start, I've been listening to Dr. Judy McAvey and Peter McCauley and Dr. Malone. I met him in person. And, of course, you know, Robert Robert Kennedy. I've been following him for so long, and so I know what this is for. I know exactly how they ruin people.
Oh, they ruin them. They ruin them permanently, and that's it. It's kind of sad to see how people who are married and committed to each other still won't be honest with each other. He went and got a shingle shot, didn't tell her, and he used to call her a conspiracy theorist, and that's sad when there's no communication like that. And she did her due diligence, and she came up with the facts, and he didn't want to hear it. It's called denial. But so these three videos are hopefully instructive. They're the kind of things that we report from the groups that Erica monitors all the time. These are very sad stories, and you can tell the guy's literally falling apart. He's headed to the last roundup. I'm not going to stop or reverse this. He started out with blood cancer, and everything just took off from there.
It's awful.
Yeah.
You know, he's likely on his way out, and she'll have to bear witness to his demise.
And
possibly have to be his caregiver.
I was just going to say that. She'll take care of him for as long as she can. This is a nice woman. You can tell. She's loyal, kind person, and is informed. So it's a tough thing. Boy, it's difficult out there. I did talk to someone recently, and he's probably listening, and he said he had a friend who has now counted, he told me, 38 people that his friend has known who are dead.
Wow.
After the shots. So I'm trying to get that individual on the program, because I want to hear. That's pretty grim. We do know a lot of stories. We've heard them. We've read them. People who know, you know, half a dozen, maybe a dozen even, people who have died in their extended family or work environment. So this thing is not slowing down, dear friends, at all. It's picking up momentum all the time.
I definitely. You know, the EMS calls are, I would say, double what they were a month ago.
I know. I can hardly talk to you anymore. The dispatcher comes roaring in, sending off another. And a lot of these calls are strange calls, though, these paramedic calls. Somebody's got a stomachache, and they call 911.
Yeah, it is odd. I suppose they think that you know, that things are going to turn bad fast, and if you drive yourself to the hospital, you'll be probably put in a queue of some sort and made to wait, whereas if you arrive in an ambulance, you may be seen quicker. Maybe that's the thinking.
A lot of falls. I keep hearing
a lot,
fall
still
dispatches.
A lot of falls, yes.
Yeah.
But, you know, in some areas, I'm mostly in Europe and probably to some extent Australia, maybe Canada, the EMS can't get to these people, you know, expediently.
Right.
I mean, I've read a few accounts where somebody calls EMS and they are waiting hours for the ambulance to show up.
This is over here?
No.
In Europe?
Europe, yes.
Yeah. Well, here, when they get a call, let's say somebody's got a stomachache, and this is a legitimate complaint. I've heard several. They'll roll a paramedic ambulance. They'll roll a regular fire engine. There's a lot of equipment, a lot of manpower, a lot of money for each one of these calls. And it's not hard to see how, if this thing gets much worse, they'll begin to stack the calls. It'll be a triage kind of a thing. They won't be able to answer them all. That's coming, I think.
Probably. I mean, they are relying a lot more on the private ambulance companies at the moment to pick up the slack.
Now, do they have full paramedic vans too, right? They're just private.
Oh, yeah. Yep.
Uh-huh. It's not like just a meat wagon where they're going to haul somebody away. So it's
more sophisticated than others. You know, you have the BLS, basic life support, and then the ALS for the advanced life support.
Right.
And there I'm seeing or hearing more calls for the ALS versus the BLS. So that means, you know, these people are critical.
Hmm. How's it? Traffic accident volume about the same?
About the same. I've not noticed anything out of the ordinary locally, anyway.
If you're listening and you want to listen in on your own local fire department, paramedic dispatch, just to see and kind of take the pulse of your community, you can go to broadcast. We don't get any money for this. Broadcastify. IFY. Broadcastify. And you can listen in for free. It's very instructive, indeed. Okay, anything else I've missed here that we need to do? I think we covered the prion thing, the mad cow proteins, and then they may be. I personally have no doubt that they are in the beef industry, and I have virtually no doubt that they are also in the dairy industry, because the flash pasteurization does not go up to 1,200 degrees. That's ridiculous. It would annihilate the food.
Well, yeah. Well, and several years ago, was it 2007? I read a report that they did test milk from dairy cows for the presence of the prion, the standard classical correct conformation prion protein that's you know, present on every cell. And they were able to detect it in milk. Now, it wasn't deemed to be infectious because it was in a normal conformation. It hadn't assumed that disease property. But if they can find the, you know, the normal protein in milk, well, it's conceivable if the cow is infected with BSE that the infectious version of that protein would turn up there as well. So are they
logical.
Screening for this?
No. And if they were, let me take that back. They probably are, but boy, is it being done on the QT. They're not going to tell us ever.
Well, they lowered the age. They only keep dairy cows for a couple of years now, so they don't.
3 years.
I think that was on purpose because they won't manifest the disease
at exactly a young age. Exactly what they're doing.
You know, and the other concern is they've also removed those exclusions or restrictions on the blood supply. You know, they used to exclude people who had spent time in the UK. They're no longer doing that.
People who have also, they used to have to screen for HIV.
Oh, that's gone,
carriers,
too.
Or it's gone. How do I say this? Let me count the ways. The blood supply is Russian roulette. And you don't just have one bullet in the sixth chamber. I would say you got one empty, if you're lucky, out of the six. They're full.
You know, when you consider they pool the blood from how many donors?
Hundreds. Oh, it's crazy. 500 cows in the average Big Mac patty of beef. How many of those cows have mad cow, BSE? Well, officially, they'll say none. You believe that? I don't think the data would support that. It's there. It's in the system. Like the guy told me, the guy who slaughtered that first mad cow in the United States, when I asked him, do you see others like this? He said, well, Jeff, we get them in all the time. They can't walk. They're obviously neurologically ruined. And they just put him in the slaughter chain. Doesn't matter. Crazy. All right.
Yeah.
We will be back on Friday with another edition for you. Thank you, young lady. Wonderful job.
Thank you, Jeff. Okay. Have a good night, everyone.
And we thank you. We'll be right back with another hour. Hang on.